It's Halsey with the Helicopter Podcast, and I hope you're enjoying listening to the podcast. But just to make sure that you are aware, if you would also like to watch the podcast, you can go to YouTube and check out the Helicopter Podcast YouTube channel. We post all of our podcasts to video format there. We're also doing a lot of really cool things over there, like vlogs. We did a bunch of fun stuff at HAI, including in-person interviews with all these amazing people. So do me a favor, head over to YouTube and check out the Helicopter Podcast. Hope you enjoy. All right, so a couple weeks ago, I headed over the Cascade Range here in Oregon and stopped by Hillsboro Aviation in Hillsboro, Oregon to chat with Max Lyons. Max has owned Hillsboro Aviation since 1999, and he's been a part of the company for even longer. This was a really cool conversation. I've known Max for a very, very long time. In fact, that's where I got my aviation start, specifically in helicopters, working line service, all the way up through instructor, 135 pilot, etc. So this was a nice trip down memory lane, chatting with Max, catching up, and hearing his story. Again, I've known him for a long time, but I didn't quite know all the story, so that was really cool. Also, the video is great, so make sure that you go to our YouTube at the Helicopter Podcast and check out the video version when you're not driving, of course. Otherwise, enjoy it. Well, Max, kind of full circle, you know, coming, I've been fortunate now to come back to Hillsboro Aviation. And every time I come back, it kind of feels like I'm coming back home, you know, because of Hillsboro Aviation and the flight schools is where I got my start. Obviously, it looks a little bit different today than when I was, you know, working back there. Just real quick, I mean, just walking around this facility here, it's incredible. I think you said, what, 55,000 square feet?
51, yeah.
51, beautiful space. What was kind of the inspiration behind just the elegance of this structure? Because it's when you arrive, when you come inside, it really feels more like a kind of an art piece. Where did that kind of all spawn from?
Yeah, thanks for saying that. You know, in like you, I've been through a lot of facilities around the world and hundreds worldwide, and I always kind of look at what impresses me and what doesn't, what is kind of the norm for a lot of flight operations, FBOs, helicopter companies. And so I just kind of kept note of what I really liked and what impressed me. And in 2014, this is our 44th year now, but so 10 years ago, 9 years ago, we sold half the company, which was Hillsboro, which is today Hillsboro Aero Flight Academy. And when we sold that, I had the option to sell this as well, not to those same buyers. There's a couple of investment funds, one out of Wall Street, one out of Philadelphia, that partnered in buying the school out. And I had the ability to, you know, kind of retire at that point. And I just didn't want to. And so I thought, you know, if I'm going to do something that I'm really proud of and that's meaningful, what does that look like? And we did well on the sale. We had basically zero debt when we sold, and we were at 90 aircraft, almost 300 employees, four or five permanent facilities, 11 remote facilities, 16 profit centers, 70,000 flight hours a year at that point. And when I sold, I thought I want a little bit more of a relaxed lifestyle than running a an operation that on our busiest days we would fly equal to 1.5 times around the equator. On
That's crazy. Day,
360 to 400 flight hours in a day.
Wow.
In 24 hours. And I wanted a more, less stressful and more relaxed lifestyle. I wanted something that I had this vision. I want something that I can be really proud of to show up every day in a facility that our customers, it kind of has a wow effect. And to have employees that I really love working with. So I brought 85 employees with me when we split the company. 15 turbine aircraft. I wanted to build a brand, rebuild Hills. I kept the name Hillsborough Aviation. The new investors changed the name of the school to Hillsborough Aero Academy. I wanted to kind of reestablish the brand and the culture from kind of a new start. For the next, kind of setting the pace for the next 20 to 30 years. And so this building was one of the cornerstones of that decision.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely gorgeous, incredible. It's so fun to walk around and actually see familiar faces.
Yeah.
Obviously, you're garnering a working environment that brings longevity with employees. I kind of want to go back a little bit to the flight school. I know that it's not part of what you're doing now, but at least when I think of you, I almost think of a bit of a visionary when it comes to flight training. I don't know the number of pilots that you've trained, but I'm one of them. Producer Zach, of course, is one, and then there's thousands of other helicopter and airplane pilots, traversing the world that all got their start here at Hillsborough Aviation. What gave you that vision early on to be able to build that flight school? Not just this traditional kind of mom and pop smaller school, but going out and developing relationships with other countries and businesses and training airline pilots from all over the world. Where did that vision come from? Because it really was a pioneering thing.
Yeah, and I have to give credit to Jerry Trimble, who started this. His dad was a very well-known utility pilot. And Jerry was one of the first, prototype test pilots for Robinson. And he came up here with a leased aircraft and started what was Hillsborough Helicopters. I met Jerry a few years after they started training here, got my licenses, came to work. And when I came to work, I had my CFI, but they wanted me, because I had a background with the Japanese culture from martial arts for many years, they wanted me to help develop a Japanese flight training program, and that turned into training pilots from 75 countries from all over the world. The number is well over 10,000 probably today. Since I've sold, they're probably approaching 12,000 to 14,000 wow. pilots, airplane and helicopters. When I was asked to do that, I didn't have a clue if we could be successful at it. And we were. The Japanese program really helped to grow the company in those first 3 to 4 years. And then at that point, a customer of ours named Ed Cooley, who I had taught to fly, showed interest in buying out the company from Jerry. And that deal was finalized September 28th, 1992. And I was, Ed had asked me to run the company. So at that point, the company had, around 20 some employees. And Ed was really a visionary. And I think more than me, he was a Harvard MBA. He built Precision Cast Parts, which was one of Oregon's Fortune 500 companies. Berkshire Hathaway purchased that for $37 billion, like back in 2016 or 18, something like that. But he did some really innovative things that had never been done before, and that was his mentality. So when he got involved with this little mom and pop company that was struggling, he was very challenging in a really positive way, but always pushing and asking for, you know, just kind of asking some tough questions. And so as my mentor, you know, I think that kind of became my style of leadership and management as well. And it's something really fascinating about it. In 1947, there was no commercial helicopter industry. It's the first helicopter went to work in commercially in Alaska with a guy named Carl Brady, who was one of the founders of ERA, ERA. Mm-hmm. And he took a Bell 47 to Alaska. But in 47, at Harvard, Ed did a thesis on the future of the commercial helicopter industry before it even started. And so he had this interest in helicopters back in the 40s, right when before the industry even was starting. He tried to get on with Bell, with Piasecki, and Command or Cayman. None of them were hiring, so he got into casting and doing some other things and built the world's leader in manufacturing jet engine blades, fans, and castings. And then when he was near retirement is when he came in to finally learn how to fly helicopters when he was in his mid-60s.
You know, it's incredible. I have a friend that I grew up, actually, was the CFO at Precision Cast Parts, mm-hmm. and a very successful company. And I actually remember learning that Ed was the founder of that. I didn't know that until, you know, some time into my tenure. You mentioned him as a mentor, obviously, a Harvard MBA. He understood business. What is some of the mentorship that you... do you still hear Ed when you're making business decisions?
Absolutely, yeah. And a lot of my comments I make to our staff, you know, were things that originated from Ed as well. But, you know, just treating people well, you know, just... being fair in every deal that you make. You know, there were a couple moments where I said, hey, you know, we could buy this company for this amount. And Ed said, I think it's worth more than that. I said, but I know we could buy the company for that amount, which is less. And he said, but is that fair? And I'd say, yeah, it's fair. And he'd go, I don't think so. But, you know, he loved people. He was... You know, Ed wasn't religious, but he's very spiritual in many ways as a just humanitarian. Really enjoyed younger people. He had been mentored, and then he chose me to mentor me, and I've kind of passed that along as well, mentoring Ryan and Natalia and John Hay and different people that have worked for us. But, you know, a lot of his philosophy was, if you can't be in the top two or three segments of your industry known, you know, in top two or three segments, you probably shouldn't be in that. If you don't have the possibility of being in it, you sure. probably shouldn't strive to be in it. So our goal was to be the top helicopter school in the country, and for a short time we were. And then we were always like number two or three for many years. Anyway,
I mean, it's. I feel very grateful to have trained at Hillsborough. I feel that I received, because you know, you go to the industry and you kind of see how other people fly, and I strongly believe that the education and the flight training that I got at Hillsborough Aviation was special. It was very organized. I was part of the 141 program, syllabus, very structured. And as I'm thinking about coming into this interview, it kind of dawned on me that when I was there, obviously you were running a big business by that point, and it wasn't just the flight school. So much more was going on. But you were responsible for creating that foundation. Take me back just a little bit to the flight school days when it was just becoming the flight school. You're just taking the helm. What were some of the marching orders and some of the visions that you had to actually build that solid foundation to create strong, safe pilots that you've accomplished?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of trial and error and learning experience. But, you know, remember, the company had been around before I joined as a manager and running that program. It had been around for 8 years, so they already had some momentum. It was small, but they had a few international students that were coming there. Actually, my instructor was from Belgium. Another instructor is from Switzerland. So there were a few international instructors there, so you know, there was already some momentum moving in that direction. But you know, the back in those days, in the early '80s, we just come out of the '70s and one of the worst economies in decades. The early '80s, where interest rates went up to 20-some percent. There were some challenging times to just survive that period, which the previous owner, you know, was flexible enough and creative enough to make it to that point. But you know, for us, one of the big breaks for us was Japan's legislation approved a tax program for writing off high-valued assets like helicopters for 100% per year. So you could write off the complete purchase. Wow. And so in the 80s, a number of corporations and wealthy individuals in Japan bought hundreds of helicopters, and they needed heliports and they needed pilots. And so because of my previous connections in Japan through martial arts, I felt comfortable, spending time over there and developing representatives and, a new market for the company. And that was kind of our big initial break. And then we developed the same thing in Taiwan and Korea, Europe. We found a really fantastic rep, Marcus Allfinger.
Yeah, of course.
Who's still one of my best friends, lifelong best friends. And he and Nicole, his wife, at that time, they really were very successful in Europe. And then we had individuals coming from all over the world. Later on, we became one of the top five biggest schools for mainland China, including the schools in mainland China. We were in the top five. And we did the same thing with Brazil, if you remember that. Mm-hmm. So those with the school, we got accreditation. We became VA approved. We developed a relationship with Portland Community College, which my wife and I helped start the aviation science program there. And that was the school side that really was taking off and growing in leaps and bounds.
I kind of joke to people because I tell them about my experience here, and I tell them, I grew up 30 minutes, from Hillsborough. But when I stepped on campus here, I was actually the foreigner, because so much of the student population on the fixed wing side was either from Asia, and all of my peers on the helicopter side were from Europe. And in fact, it was really neat. This past November, I went to European Rotors in Spain.
Oh, did you? Good
and
for you.
It was like a Hillsborough aviation reunion.
Really?
Specifically because when I was at Hillsborough, a lot of Norwegians at that time.
Oh, yeah.
And so at the show, I probably ran into 15, 20 people.
Oh, wonderful.
A lot of Norwegians, some of the Germans, some of the French students. So that was a neat experience, especially being young.
Yeah.
And being able to kind of immerse myself. I forget the exact date. I think it's May the 15th or 17th is kind of the Independence Day for Norway. So that was always a fun celebration, on campus. And that was a neat experience. Being in business now for myself, I've started to expand to kind of more of a global reach. And I've discovered that every country does business a little bit different. And it's really important to go in and respect that and understand that. Mm-hmm. How have you been so successful at garnering relationships and doing business in so many countries? What has been that secret sauce for you of being able to develop those relationships and to get big deals done outside of the United States?
Yeah, well, I grew up in a small town in Washington State, a lumber community and fourth generation logging family. Right out of high school, I went into the woods, choker setter, hooker. I worked for Evergreen Helicopters as a hooker underneath S-64s and 205s. Flew in Hiller Saloys every day. And I made a pile of money, and I didn't want to be a logger the rest of my life. So I took off with a backpack, and I traveled. I hitchhiked around the world, mostly solo for a period of time, and traveled across North Africa, across the Northern Sahara from Morocco to Egypt, and down into Central and East Africa, and caught a rusty tanker to India. Spent about 10 months on the Indian subcontinents and the Himalayas and the Hindu Kush, and turned 21 in Kabul, Afghanistan.
Wow.
And I came back from that trip with just under 30 countries I traveled to. And I found I loved other cultures. That was really the catalyst to me wanting to do international business. I loved other people. I was, you know, the poorest of the poor in Africa. I was treated like a long lost son. I was in villages where people my age had never seen a white person. And this is 50 years ago. This is a half a century
ago.
And so I came back and I had this wanderlust to travel more. But I made friends all over the world. And actually, one guy in particular who became a mentor of mine as well, who was kind of a famous character in India that I'd met. And I just realized that, you know, that you could live in, you know, you could live kind of an uncommon life.
Mm-hmm.
I used to tell my daughters, you know, that, you know, my whole desire was not to live a common life, was to do something different. In the international travel, and then later on, as we started developing international business was really where my heart was at.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you've excelled at that. You continue to excel in building those relationships. Fourth generation logger. I don't think I knew that, actually. I was I knew a lot about you. I wanted to do a little homework, of course, to kind of refurb, and I know in your bio it talks about that. I'm curious, you know, obviously you're setting chokers and you're working around helicopters for that industry. Is that where the spark kind of initially hit?
Yeah.
I'm curious to kind of go back a little bit from the beginning of how you go from a logging family to a world traveler to then getting into helicopters.
Thank you to our sponsor, Precision Aviation Group. Mission critical operators and fleet managers rely on Precision Aviation Group as a worldwide leading rotor and fixed wing MRO provider. PAG provides tip to tail solutions in four MRO segments: avionics, components, engines, and manufacturing DER services. A single point of contact gives you access to over 150 million in inventory globally 24/7. Just call 800-537-2778. Precision Aviation Group. Others sell parts. We sell support.
I was logging. I was doing cat and hide lead logging, which is using the tree and the spar tree or the tower, metal tower, and working for a family business, my father's company. And I realized very quickly that's not where I wanted to be. And I had heard that Columbia Helicopters was logging down the road, and so was Evergreen. And so I went to work for Evergreen, and just as a choker setter, and I was flying in and out of the canyons and the woods pretty much every day, you know, being dropped off not long after daybreak and 12 hours later being picked up. And it was pretty hard work. But I made really good money, and I loved the short flights in and out of the canyons that we were landing in and taking off from. But in those days, it was post Vietnam. Vietnam was just ending at that point in 75, and this was in 74. And so all the pilots were high time guys out of Vietnam. And the chances of getting a civilian training to become a commercial helicopter pilot and finding a job was almost non-existent at that point. So I thought about it, but I was like, nah, I can't do that. I'm not smart enough, but the industry's too tough to even get into it. And so I didn't think about it for a period of time. And after my trip, I came back. Went back into the woods logging because I was broke, got into construction, and at one point, one of my Aikido students in martial arts in downtown, in Chinatown, in downtown Portland, I realized he was a helicopter instructor at Hillsboro Helicopters. And I said, yeah, I used to work for a helicopter company, and I kind of fantasized learning to fly, but you know, no jobs are available. And he goes, yeah, they are. You know, you can find a job. And he told me how to do it. Went for a demo flight, and that was that was the moment where I had an epiphany where I could do this.
Hook, line, and sinker. The demo flight is probably the most effective tool.
Yes, it is.
I don't want to throw Lisa Davis under the bus, my first instructor, because I think I was one of her first demos. She was a very new instructor, and she messed up. You know, the demos were traditionally a 0.3. Mm-hmm. Well, I got a 0.8 to include landing at the downtown heliport. And for me, I had never thought about helicopters. I was fascinated with aviation, and that was my path. But I thought it was going to be in airplanes. And, you know, the demo flight was a birthday present from my parents.
Great.
And taking the control, I mean, I remember it coming back specifically, flying over 26. It feels like yesterday. Of being so overwhelmed by this crazy machine, you know, the R-22 at that time of, oh my God, I don't even know if I could do this, but I want to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, by the end of the week, I think I had my loan application out with Wayne Moore at the time.
Wayne,
I got hired by Rob James that same week, working line service, so I could take part of the employee discount, which thank you for offering that, by the way. Because that was a really neat program. And the line service experience actually was probably some of the, I feel like it's one of those jobs that helps shape you.
Yeah.
I always recommend to people getting into aviation, if you have the opportunity to do something within the space that's not flying, whether it's dispatch or working line service, I think it's so important. I do want to jog your memory a little bit. And transition over to me for a second, because I'm always curious to hear, because I've talked about it on the podcast of mistakes that I thought I made during my training. One of the big topics that we push on the podcast is this idea that your interview starts day one of flight training. And I came into, I was young and arrogant, I think is a good way to say naive and cocky.
I don't remember that about you. But
what was your impression? What do you recall working with me?
You were a smart, energetic guy, and I think about at a very young age you moved into a pretty leadership, pretty strong leadership role. I mean, in the end, I think running the program over in Trotville.
I was, yeah,
and you did a great job there. So no, I have very positive. I don't remember you as being arrogant anything. So
maybe it's self.
And I'm proud of you and proud of so many of our graduates that we have. I'm a little bit off track here, but I look at other industries, other businesses, and I think, what other industry would I want to be in than aviation? And I would describe myself as kind of a serial entrepreneur, but I look at different things and from construction, logging, running a retail business, manufacturing, and I'm looking as I'm driving down the road going, boring, 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 boring. And I can't think of anything that's more fulfilling, rewarding, exciting than our industry. Also very challenging. It's a complex industry where I tell people that if you're running a family coffee shop, and you're buying coffee and you're paying, workers' comp and you have a couple employees, it's a complex business. If you move into aviation with regulations and safety and quality and the capital investment, it's like almost an impossible venture to be successful in. And yet, a number of companies survive and thrive in it.
I want to talk about that, but real fast, I also am just curious, and I'm wondering if it's because of just your intuitiveness of being who you are, if it's part of your world travels, but something that I took away from my experience when I was a student and an employee at Hillsborough Aviation, I think it was my second or third day working the line. I remember it again like yesterday. You drove your car out as you were leaving, and I was, I think, working the closing shift, and you took time to talk with me and ask me about who I am and where I'm from and what I'm doing and what my goals were. And even as a 19-year-old kid at the time, I realized that was unique, that the owner of this company, who has lots of employees and lots going on, took 5 or 10 minutes to come and talk with me. And then I noticed that through the years of working for you, whether it's coming to the CFI meetings, during the strategic planning events, consistently engaging with your employees and continually mentoring and growing those relationships, was that just an intuitive part of how you thought that that was the best way to do the business? Because I think it's a lot of business owners, I think, fail at that.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a couple pieces to that story. One is, I don't have an MBA. I didn't go to college. I've taken business classes and managerial accounting and some other areas. I had a great mentor, with Ed, and I have a great outside board of directors. Jack Erickson's been on my board for 27 years, and Lamar Halgard, he was chief pilot for 26 years at Horizon Airlines, and some other really great board members. So I've had some good mentoring through the years, but I don't have the college degree, education, or the MBA. And people have asked me, so why do you think you've been successful? And I've been asked that by even childhood friends. And my initial response, I have no clue. But the truth is, I really think that travel, that trip for me, I was actually pretty shy as a young guy. I had a lot of my own insecurities and such, but that trip kind of empowered me, and I met people, and I loved their stories, and I found that my story as a kid from a small town with really nothing of interest, that people were interested in what I was doing traveling around the world solo. And so I just found I really fell in love with other people's stories and truly interested in it. And so, there's other things that came with the success, the hard work and the hours and all of that, but a lot of it came down to genuinely liking other people and their stories. And so, I think that's probably the crux of this, most of our success. We've had a number of other good things happen, good timing with certain markets that we got into, but just being interested in other people. One of our senior managers at the school at one point, one of our senior accountants, and I won't mention who it is, but you know her, she approached our general manager at one point and said, she just started with us, and she said, Max just stopped by my office and was asking me about my history and where I'm from and what my dreams are. And is that normal? And is he serious? And then later on, that general manager, again, who is no longer over there, he approached me at one point. He goes, so-and-so told me that you stopped by your office and you're asking about her. Do you do that because that's good for business? Or do you genuinely have an interest in that? I went, yeah, I genuinely have an interest for that, which that's the way I look at it. Is it good for building lifelong friendships? Yeah, and trust and loyalty. And that's not why you do it. You do it because you have an interest in other people.
Yeah, I think it's important, and I think it's a place where, unfortunately, a lot of business owners fail. In fact, I remember you coming to the Troutdale office and asking me to go through the P&L with you for that location. And, I look back at that now, and it's like, that was a wonderful foundation that I got. And it's something that I've been able to implement, into my own business and that understanding. And so that was an interesting, very cool thing that I thought. And probably a part of the longevity. Again, walking through your hangar today, and I'm seeing very familiar faces of people that I've worked with, when I started flight training and then, working through my years. Going back to the complexity of any business, but specifically aviation, it's not for the faint of heart. You've had ownership of this business since 1992, and you've been leading it ever since at a ferocious charge. You haven't let go. You haven't taken your foot off the gas pedal. How do you navigate the complexity, and how do you keep the energy, and how do you keep moving in the direction where you're only continuing to grow?
It's a great question. Actually, my ownership was 99. I ran it for Ed from 92 to 99, and we were like partners, but I bought it out in 99. But, you know, I think early on, I was driven by fear of failure, of just, you know, worried that, you know, if we didn't work harder, spend more hours, be more creative, we just weren't going to make it. I was traveling quite a bit through the years, especially, well, when Ed owned the company and after 99 when I bought it. So sometimes I was gone every 6 weeks someplace, either around the world or domestically. And a lot of it was new relationships, meeting new people and kind of seeing where there was opportunities for buying and selling aircraft, which became, you know, at one point we were so diverse. We had the school, we had aircraft, we had sales, total sales, and then we had flight operations. And they were almost a third, and a third in profitability. And so, you know, early on, I had this feeling that we needed to stay diverse to survive the worst of times, which we went through. And I look on, you know, there were some periods in those early years where we were hitting home runs. You know, it was like Houston Hickenbottom and I, at one point, it was like we were talking and kind of laughing and high-fiving each other and going, how much better can things be?
Yeah.
I mean, because opportunities were just flowing through the door daily. We were turning down 9 out of 10 of them because we just didn't have the bandwidth and the capacity. And then things turned in 08, and it was like we were walking through the facility going, how much worse could things be? You know, we had, you know, just some challenging times there that were really humbling, but we survived them. But what that taught me was, you know, not to get full of myself or let us get full of ourselves thinking that times will always be great, being more conservative, not having a lot of debt, and always looking for new markets. But, you know, we've gone through some dry spells. I would describe, you know, the last 4 or 5 years of a period of the greatest uncertainty of my career in the last 4 to 5 years. And a lot of it is because of the economy, the pandemic, residual effect of the 2008 recession, staffing challenges, and basically trying to identify the next move for a platform for an aircraft that will kind of call it be the next generation. And with Black Hawks coming out by the hundreds, I was afraid of contract pricing being depressed, which we're seeing that. We looked at pretty much every type of flying platform from CH-47Ds, Black Hawks, S-61s, K-Maxes, 412s. I've looked at an array of different opportunities, and it was really there was a period of kind of a dry spell where it was really hard to, you know, be clear on what, call it a crystal ball, you know, for the future was going to look like. And so, you know, as an owner, I think you're constantly always trying to see a little bit into the future, if it's 5 years or 10 years, as to which direction you should invest in. And this last 5 years has been a bit challenging.
You know, it's crazy. I'm just starting my entrepreneurial journey. It's been, you know, 4 years now of me doing my business. And it's so complex, and it's actually kind of lonely sometimes. I feel like it's a lonely existence because most of your peers, they go to their 9 to 5, and not that there's anything wrong with that, but that's just kind of status quo. And so it feels lonely. What speaking to me as now a young fellow entrepreneur, what is some of the best advice in this aviation space that you could give?
Bell is proud to sponsor Vertical Helicasts and their vision to hold meaningful mission, safety, and best practice conversations in the helicopter industry. The lessons learned from these conversations will undoubtedly shape the future of both new and veteran helicopter operators.
You mean advice that I haven't followed, including?
Of course.
Stay healthy. You know, don't let the stress get too much for you. However you can deal with that through, you know, exercise or eating healthy. But, you know, make sure you put in the time with your family. I asked my wife and I and my two daughters were sitting, and it came up where I said something about being a not being as present as I should have been. Mm-hmm. As a father, and Carol, my wife, asked Rick and Hannah, my daughters, did you feel that your dad wasn't present? And they said no, which kind of surprised me, because if I have a regret, it's that I traveled so much and I was gone from the family so much. But they said, you were there for the birthdays, the piano and dance recitals and graduations and all of the important events in our life, and we took family vacations and all of that. So that felt really good, even though I'm not sure if they're being totally honest with me, but I think they are. But I think, just make sure you take time for your family and your health and your own personal life. This business adventure is really probably one of the greatest adventures you can go through in life, but at the end, it's not the most important thing.
Yeah, it's hard sometimes. I think you think that you're doing the right thing for your family. Mm-hmm. Right, we're taught to provide, and specifically being a male, be the leader of the house, and I'm already finding that out, that yes, that's a role and a responsibility. My wife is actually an employee of my company, so both of our salaries depend on our success, so it adds that extra pressure. But I've already seen in my 4 years a drifting at times away from making her the center of my attention and my own health. Yeah. I'm back on a health kick right now, because good. 2023 was rough. It was a hard year for business. We were able to show some growth, which was so exciting, but it was hard fought. Mm-hmm. Producer Zach had to go and almost kill himself in a car, so that he left our business for a short time, and it was just, it all kind of mounted. So I think it's really nice to hear that from you, of that being your advice, of being consistent with your family and understanding that's really the important thing.
Yeah,
I do recall many times seeing your family at Hillsboro.
Yeah,
Carol and Reka and Hannah. In fact, I feel like Reka and I were, I think, similar ages.
Yeah,
she became a friend. Mm-hmm. She was someone I knew well. I actually took her on a helicopter training flight one time, which was pretty cool. So I feel like you probably did a little bit of a better job than you thought. And it sounds like, they feel that way. Transitioning to this platform and what you're doing now and some of the very exciting news coming from Hillsboro, I have to say this last HAI, the last ever HAI now being transitioned to VAI, there was so much buzz around the H145D3, mm-hmm. specifically the Hillsboro branded platform that was at the Airbus area. Walk me through that. And for our listeners, if we could kind of layman's terms it down a little bit, of what's currently being used in a Type 2 capacity and what makes this platform and you so excited about this coming into the fire world?
Yeah, good question. Starting about 13 years ago, the U.S. Forest Service, a senior person of the U.S. Forest Service, approached me, because we own Helitrade, which is the the company that did the engineering behind the STCs that put a 212 rotor system on 205A model A1 models and put a -17B engine in it, and then did a bunch of other STCs, 9 seats, dual hydraulics, dual batteries, stuff like that, a group of STCs that enhanced the performance of the 205. And in the Type 2 exclusive use world, especially for the U.S. Forest Service, the Bell Medium 200 Series 205, 212, 205 A1++, which is the STCs that we own, became the preferred platform for the U.S. Forest Service for transporting firefighters. And that's a 60-year-old design. So I was being asked as the STC holder of that platform, how many more years do you think this is supportable or viable as a transportation for U.S. firefighters? And I just threw out a number and said, 4 more contract cycles, 16 years. And then about 10 years ago, the U.S. Forest Service started kind of saying, you know, if we were looking at another platform, what platform do you think could replace the 205? And I personally, you know, I looked at the 145 D3 as the as a next replacement for the 205. But it didn't have the performance that it has today with this newest D3 that's out there. And so we started providing, just suggested pricing of what may happen if a 412 EPX or an Airbus, you know, enters the market. What's the daily rate going to be? And back then the budget was a substantial increase in daily rates, but we knew that that 60-year-old platform with the 205. Mm-hmm. If it waited another 10 years, it's going to be 70. Another 10 years, it's going to be 80. So the Forest Service really started warming to this idea in the last 3 to 5 years. I mentioned earlier that I looked at all these Blackhawks and CH-47s and 61s and all of this different opportunities. I decided that I believed with Airbus increasing the performance of the 145, that would be one of the options for the Forest Service in the future. And so we committed by, you know, ordering one that was delivered just a few months ago in December, which we now have a contract for. And then my plan is to add more of those during the next contract bid period, which I think will take this Hillsborough Aviation out probably another 10 to 20 years into the future as still being in the vanguard, the leader of transportation of firefighters, which, you know, there's 34 contracts make that up. And today there's going to be some 332 Super Pumas.
Yeah, sure.
That are doing rappel. There's going to be 412 EPXs, and there's going to be probably, I would assume, kind of an even number of 145 D3s, or jokingly I say, tell Airbus D4s or D5s, which they've told me that that's not on the agenda.
It's not on the docket.
But I think that, you know, we just, you know, I said earlier that we've been going through some years of uncertainty. This gives us certainty again, especially on the firefighting side, and remaining as one of the leading companies for transporting firefighters.
With the industry, like you said, I mean, it's crazy to think that the aircraft that are being used now are very old machines and continue to age, but it's what the industry is familiar with. Mm-hmm. Is it hard to move that change?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I know even some of my staff down on the shop floor probably criticize me for, you know, making this move. 205 is still a great performer, but it's a 60-year-old design. Even though it's been upgraded with the engineering from Helitrade and Hillsborough Aviation, it's still a 60-year-old platform that at some point will not be viable to operate, financially not viable. It could be an AD that downs the fleet. Mm-hmm. It could be an accident. But, you know, it's still a great aircraft because they're moving more into this next generation. Doesn't mean they'll stop using 205s. I think they will still be used for call when needed.
Sure.
Still outperforms the 412 and the 145. at least for the next 3 to 5 years, I think it will, maybe longer. It outperforms it. It's less expensive. For dropping water, I think it's going to be a great option. State forestries, it'll be a great option. And it'll still continue to be used in private sector for maybe some private forest lands and such as well. But there has to be some transition moving into the next generation of, call it faster, safer, more sophisticated aircraft that can be supportable for another 30, 40 years into the future.
I was fortunate enough to do an Airbus demo, not this past HI, but the HI before in the 145. And
I know,
you know, kind of blew my mind.
Me too.
Talk to me just a little bit about your first experience operating the aircraft, or really just tell me some of the things about the machine. Obviously, the helicopter podcast, we should dive a little bit deep into what makes that 145 so special, not just from an airframe perspective, but also the avionics suite.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's a BK-117. You know, it's an aircraft that was, you know, designed in Germany, and was any EMS and other uses, you know, for decades. A little bit newer type certificate than the 205 from early Vietnam or from the UH-1H. Airbus is what's impressed me about Airbus, their innovation and their ability to continue to drive innovation and improvements. And, you know, and that's what they did with this BK-117. It's not the BK-117 that our fathers knew.
Sure.
You know, or that were earlier in our careers. This is a complete different machine, and a lot of it has to do with the sophistication of the avionics and electronics on board. You know, the engines have been upgraded, the rotor system's upgraded. There's a lot of carbon fiber on the machine, making it lighter. Military and, you know, I think has 600 and some Lakotas flying out there. So it's proof of concept is this modern form of the 145 has been proven over and over again. And for me flying it, I'm going to go through the 3-week Airbus course. I just went through a few days and flew it a couple weeks ago. And it's very intuitive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was a bit intimidated by it. I'm a single engine, helicopter pilot for decades. And I climbed in it, and picking it up felt like I'd been in it for years before. It just felt very comfortable. And the complexity of the systems is kind of what the 3 weeks of training's for.
Sure.
Is to understand all the systems and emergency procedures and such. But it is really an exciting aircraft. I'm pretty blown away by it.
Yeah, it's incredible, and it was certainly the talk of the town at this past HAI. Was that a special moment? You've been in the industry for so long, and anyone that you talk to in the industry, everyone knows Max. Mm. You know, you've built such a reputation and a positive reputation, which is not always the easiest thing to do within this industry. Was it fun to be at this HAI with a bit of the crown jewel of the show?
Yeah, and my daughter, Reka, is our marketing branding manager. She's now doing some other stuff in D.C., but she still is kind of running that. She was at the show with us, and the way that it was presented, you know, I loved the way that Airbus presented it in the booth. Mm-hmm. I had people coming up to me and leaning over to me and saying something, and I couldn't hear them initially, and I said, "What?" And they said, you're making a shock through the industry. And I go, "How's that?" And they said, "The 145 for firefighting." And the truth is, I had so many people congratulate us on that move. Senior people that had retired from Bell, people at Airbus, at the highest level of Airbus. And then a lot of industry friends that stopped by and saw the aircraft. And I look at it and I say, I don't know if it's going to be true or not, Halsey, but you know, of my career, when I look back, I think that that could be one of the most meaningful influences maybe that Hillsborough Aviation had and I had on the industry, was helping to move the Forest Service into next generation aircraft, and us taking the risk of buying the first one and having it ready for this season. But yeah, it was very rewarding. It was an exciting show for us. I don't know if we'll see a show that's that exciting again for, you know, a number of years into the future.
The show was exciting. Kind of as we wrap up, you've been in the industry for so long. I feel like I'm an old codger in the industry, and I'm, compared to your tenure, I'm just starting. HAI, you were the board, you were the chair of the board for a time, and you've been involved with HAI, now rebranding to VAI to kind of reflect vertical lift. What is your kind of overall opinion of the current state of the industry and, you know, the decision of that rebranding? I feel like it does impact the industry significantly. I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think Bart, the CEO of Airbus America, you know, I forgot the term he used, but, you know, this is a very challenging time, time of uncertainty and challenges, and as an industry, for the OEMs, for operators, for all of us in this industry. And you know, hopefully there's going to be more certainty kind of moving forward with a lot of things that we're going through. I mean, OEMs are still having a hard time sourcing parts, you know. There's, you know, engine deliveries are behind. There's a whole bunch of things that are causing that challenge. When I look at Helicopter Association International or Vertical, you know, the new name, you know, I describe it as when I transitioned from round gauges in helicopters to glass, I had a kind of like, I had a moment where I went, I don't like this.
Sure.
I don't feel comfortable. Where's all the information at?
Yeah.
And it was a bit intimidating, but I think 10 hours into it or less, I was like, this is pretty cool. You know, this is, the situational awareness is like nothing I've ever seen before. Once I started really understanding of, you know, how to pull information out of the glass, out of the instrument panel. And it in the end, it made me a safer, better pilot. I think that, you know, when I first heard the name change, it kind of was like, you know, I'm not sure about that.
Sure.
But, you know,
same.
we all have to be flexible and open-minded on things. Otherwise, we kind of get stuck in the past. I think that the current board, I was on that board for 6 years and chairman just for the one. But I think that this current board went through a lot of thought in doing that. And I think James Viola did a good job leading him through that process. So I think it needed to move into the 21st century, and they have.
Yeah, it's an interesting time. You know, there's so much kind of uncertainty of what the actual future looks like, and I think there's a lot of big ideas out there. But I'm also concerned that those big ideas are taking up a lot of resources for certification, and
you're talking autonomous flight. You're talking electric vehicles.
Absolutely,
I do. I think so too. I think you're right on. I think that, you know, you want to start it early, but I think it's still quite a few years out.
I think so.
And we're not going to invest in those areas right now. We don't see a near-term return in doing that.
It's interesting, and you know, obviously as time moves forward, things change. It's just kind of the cycle of how life works. As we wrap up, I mean, this has been a full circle moment for me, Max.
Me too.
To think that as a 19-year-old kid working line service, to now being able to come and sit in your office and have this conversation, it's a really neat moment. You've been instrumental in my career, and so many other people. I think that there's probably so many people that you've mentored and influenced that you maybe not even know of, right? Walking through the facility downstairs, there's a picture of two Long Rangers that are that was, I think, on the cover of Vertical magazine, and here I am now with Vertical on MHM Publishing, being able to be on this Helicast platform and have these conversations with industry titans like yourself. So thank you for that. To our listeners on the Vertical Helicast platform, thank you so much for supporting us. We had a great time at HAI, so many fun interviews. And this has been kind of a fun extension of HAI, because HAI, we kind of centered around CEOs. A lot of the OEM CEOs I had the fortune to talk with. And to be able to come here today and have this conversation with you has just been incredible. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Jose. I'm proud of you.
Thanks.
Proud of what you're doing.
It's fake it till you make it sometimes. And,
You
know, I'm learning every single day. And it's interesting, the nuggets that you pick up, the things that I remember from my time here are deep-rooted that still guide me into my journey that I'm in now. So I appreciate that. Thank you for your hospitality. Thank you for the tour. And congratulations on 40-plus years of doing something incredible.
Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thanks, Max. Hey, podcast listeners. My name is Halsey Schreider, and I'm the principal broker and owner of Cellocopter. Cellocopter is a new-age, data-driven, helicopter-specific sales brokerage bringing helicopter listings to new heights. At Cellocopter, we utilize digital positioning, paid advertising, and our large network of industry professionals to move your helicopter quickly and efficiently. Unsure the value of your helicopter? Lucky for you, Cellocopter offers a complimentary market evaluation. All you have to do is contact the team today. Are you ready to take your helicopter listing from mayday to payday? Easy. Fill out the contact information below, and a Cellocopter pilot agent will reach out shortly. Cellocopter. List it, sell it, done.